Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Welcome to the Standard Sportsman Podcast. The show features trending topics, touching all aspects of duck and goose hunting in an effort to motivate others to leave the resource better than they found it. Hosts Cason Short and Brent Birch are lifelong Arkansas hunter conservationists, delivering thought-provoking discussions with engaging guests before, during, and after duck season. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into today's show with the guys.
Hey guys, it's Brent Birch back with another episode of the Standard Sportsman Podcast. Joined as always by my co-host Cason Short. And if you pay attention to his social media account, it's almost May and he's got speckle bellies on campus. So that's pretty wild, man.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a debate yesterday between myself and my partner here. They got up and were circling, and there was a little argument of whether or not they were snow geese. And I was like, man, they're brown. So we immediately turned the truck off and listened for them, and they circled, and there's no mistaking that note. Pretty neat, different for sure, I would say, to have them close to May, but pretty neat nonetheless.
Yeah, that is wild. It makes you wonder where they spent the winter to just be moving this late, because that's abnormal times 1,000.
Absolutely. I posted about that. I guess by the time this comes out, it'll be yesterday. So my guess, based on other GPS information stuff we've seen on kind of the way that migration works, my best guess is these are Louisiana birds. A lot of those birds that stay south of us seem to move a little later in the year. Body condition is likely worse on those birds, so they don't really want to get up there and fight that ice line and fight the cold weather and everything else. So they stay down here, they feed, and then they'll kind of make one big push when they move. Look like, I know you can't judge them all by their bellies, but they look like mostly juvenile birds. Couldn't see, obviously, the white mark on the front of them or not, but I know that's more genetic than anything else, but still, you had a decent indicator from the ground anyway. So that would be my guess. Southern birds just had a rough winter and are kind of hanging out, living the easy life down here in the spring until it's time to go.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip wader features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience, as I have sent my original pair of Sitka waders from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip wader from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce wax shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days of field. So if you'd like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick and mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi.
Yeah, so rough winter, you're referring to kind of quality of habitat, what they're finding in Louisiana. I mean, we've obviously, Arkansas has benefited from that, but is that what you're getting at?
Yes. Sorry. I should explain that better. I sometimes speak at too high a level. The loss of rice production in Louisiana, particularly Southwest Louisiana, has really hurt white fronts as far as the quality of habitat. And then the disturbance is pretty high as well with crawfish farms. So you're getting birds that are getting kicked all the time, either from propane cannons, people checking traps. You know, it's a greater extent than what we talk about here as far as the pressure and disturbance. But, you know, we're getting there pretty good as hard as we chase them here in this state. So, yeah, the combination of those two factors, increased disturbance. So the birds are having to travel more to find food. And then, you know, it's same for us. If we had to run a marathon to get to a McDonald's, we'd all be pretty skinny.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. well, we scrambled, I think is a good way to put it. But we scrambled for a guest. We had another guy set to come on. He had a sick child, and then he's booked up the rest of the week. And we're kind of late in the week recording anyway, because we release on Thursdays, and this is Wednesday morning. But why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest for this week?
Yeah, man, he answered the bell, so I appreciate him showing up. And it's a good segue from White Fronts, because that's exactly how I met our guest today. Ed Wall is going to join us. And if you've seen that DUTV episode, Spec Hunting Here, or really or most anything you've seen, we'll talk about it. But Ed Wall is probably one of the guys behind the camera making it happen. Ed, appreciate you jumping on here quick with us, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, I appreciate the invite.
So you're traveling today. Where are you headed right now?
We were filming over in North Georgia yesterday. So got one of my guys over there filming today. I'm actually headed to Lost Break, the island we've got up in Mississippi River, in Missouri. So I'm headed up there to go film a turkey hunt the next couple of days. I've got a friend of mine, Megan Patrick, who's a country music singer. She's coming over to meet us today, and she's going to hunt with us the next couple of days. Do a little filming on the island.
Yeah. I'll back up. Maybe should tell Brent this now. Brent, Ed is an Ole Miss guy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. maybe the first official one on the podcast. So
I think better, that's right.
Try to class this thing up a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, we've had plenty of Mississippi State related folks on here. So, yeah, I think this might be a first Ole Miss tie-in.
Yeah.
Good deal.
When you have to move away from real science and get into visual arts, I guess we got to go to Oxford. So,
touche.
So, Ed, I mean, you've got your hands in so much stuff right now. Man, super happy for you. I know you're staying busy. You got all kinds of stuff going on. But to take us back to kind of your start, because you and I, obviously you enjoy photography. I do as well. We trade notes sometimes on equipment and other stuff. But where did it start for you?
Honestly, I just bought a camera kind of as a hobby to take some pictures while we were duck hunting, take some pictures of my dogs. My buddy's on duck hunting, and I'd actually seen this coffee table book a buddy of mine had made years ago that just had pictures while we were duck hunting. I thought that was a really cool thing, and so I kind of wanted to make one of those to just preserve some memories. And so I did a little research and talked to people about what camera to buy. I literally had no clue, never owned when I was younger, I'd videotaped a lot of deer hunts and turkey hunts and stuff over the years, but I'd never had an actual still camera. So I really didn't know what to buy or anything. So I did some research and bought a pretty decent one. So it actually just kind of started out as a hobby that I spent, you know, lots of years taking lots of really bad pictures. But I figured out early on that I enjoyed doing it and just wanted to learn more about it. And it was something I really liked doing. So obviously, I did more and more research on it and tried to get better at it. And somewhere along the line, it went from being a hobby to actually making a little money with it. Some companies started reaching out, wanting to pay me for some stuff. And that kind of grew and grew. And I eventually just realized that, hey, this is what I love doing. And I'm can actually make some money at it. And so I talked to my wife about it and decided I was just going to go all in on it. And kind of grown from there.
I was going to say, you mentioned taking bad pictures. It's funny, man. I look back at stuff I shot 2, 3, even 5 years ago and think, what on earth? Why did I think that was a decent picture back then? It's amazing kind of how you progress. And I guess I mentioned that for all the other hobbyists out there that that look at their stuff and are disappointed and they compare it to something they see on social media, man, just keep on clicking that shutter button and keep learning, keep working. Cause I think we all grow as we go.
100%. It's so that it's kind of funny you say that. So the coffee table book, it's kind of the origin of all this. I did one, I think every year I've had my dog who's 10 or 11 now. So I've got all these books from every year. Each year after duck season, I would do this coffee table book and I look back at some of them and especially those early ones. And it's funny to look back and remember thinking then, man, these are really good pictures. And I look back now and think, man, they were not. I thought they were. And even from a handful of years ago, it's, you can see a progression. Obviously, I mean, the more you do something, the better you're going to get at it. But even, a few short years ago, when I thought, man, these are getting really, these are getting good. And I look back and even on those, I'm just kind of like, man, maybe not as good as I thought they were at the time. So it's kind of funny to look back and just kind of see that progression.
Well, I'm neither. I'm not the hobbyist or the professional. And I mean, every once in a while, I look into one that looks pretty decent, but I've done the coffee table books, just of hunts and people I've hunted with and just trying to capture those experiences. 99% of those never see social media or anything else. Cause I mean, they're my memories. My room, right. My room at duck camp is the walls are covered in pictures, from way back when I was a kid up until, last season. So, I think everybody gets captivated by taking pictures, but some a lot better than others. I mean, you get buddies that take pictures, after a good, fun hunt with your buddies, and they take a picture and it's terrible. Somebody's cut off, somebody's head's cut off, the feet are cut off, whatever. But even all that is, it's still worth it, obviously. But you mentioned some of the brands, and I've seen your stuff with Mossy Oak and Drake, and you worked with a lot of notable brands. But did they find you through social media? I mean, were they combing Instagram and someone across, some of your work and say, man, that guy, he's taking some sweet pictures. Is that how they found you?
Yeah. Drake was one of the first ones who reached out. And so I was on their creative team years ago, which, was for me, it was such an honor to have, a big company in the waterfowl industry thought enough of my work that they wanted to send me some free gear and use my pictures for stuff. So every time someone like them or Mossy Oak repost a picture, it was always, it was a cool thing because it kind of validated that, hey, what you're doing is there's somebody else that likes it as well. So, but yeah, it kind of started with Drake and Mossy Oak and just kind of grew from there. I've had a bunch of brands reach out over the years that I've done a bunch of work with that have, I guess most of them, have, I guess all of them have kind of found me on social media for the most part.
Well, anybody out there that's not, not paying attention on social media, I challenge you to go pick up an issue of DU's magazine. You may have to find it in the crease between the pages. Sometimes they hide credit down in there pretty tight, but go look at any magazine and you'll likely find some of Ed's work in it. I get chosen very rarely in that magazine, but every one I look at, Ed's kicking my butt.
I don't know about that, but yeah, that was kind of a cool thing. That was one of my big goals years ago, was getting into DU magazine, and they did that photo contest every year, which was a really cool thing they still do. And that was kind of how it started. Won their photo contest, and the photo editor reached out to me and said, "Hey, we'd like to pay you for some pictures." And I was blown away because my initial goal was just to get one of my pictures in a DU magazine. When it happened, I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. I'd never envisioned that it'd get to a point where they were paying me for pictures. And even now, still, Casey, you're in there quite often. They don't actually tell you that you're going to, that they're going to use your pictures. It's kind of a cool deal. It shows up in the mail. So we don't know until it shows up whether or not they've used any of our pictures for that issue until it shows up at your doorstep. And it's kind of fun for me to thumb through it kind of see what they've used.
Yeah, it's like a Where's Waldo deal.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
I tell you what gets me though, and then maybe this is just me being critical of myself, but I feel like they never pick the images that I really like. They're usually, and that kudos to DU for that, I guess. Most of their stuff they pick of mine, and maybe it's because I'm not a very good photographer, but it's more what the subject is or what it has to do with the article and the story. You know, like I'll send in something for an article. I'm like, oh man, this image is fantastic. And then they pick up an image that I wouldn't want to show on social media. I'm like, oh, that's what you guys wanted to use.
Yeah, exactly. That's, and of course, you know, photography is subjective anyway. So it's always, there was one, I think a recent issue when we got the email that said, hey, these are the images we're looking for. There was one that stood out to me. I was like, well, I've got that image. It's for sure. They're going to use this. And it was actually, it was the ducks flying through with the moon in the background. And
yeah,
2 seasons ago, I had sat on this waterfowl refuge one afternoon. And I quickly realized, because I do that so often, that where I was set up, I had to set up in a certain spot for the sun, but the ducks, there's a bunch of ducks over there in this refuge, but my hide wasn't great. And I realized they were landing a little far out for me to get some really good stuff. And this moon is a full moon. It was just mid-afternoon. It's already in the sky. And I saw this duck fly through it, and I thought, well, that would be a cool picture. So I sat there for several hours just waiting for this group of ducks to fly right. They kept flying under the moon. I wanted them to fly right through it. And they finally did. And I got this shot. And then we get the email. And I was like, well, I've got that picture. And I sent it in. They didn't use it. So I was like, well, what do I know?
Well, you and I've had this conversation before, man. Like you'll go out and you envision the shot, right? So like you go find location, everything, the light, the birds, you get the shot, right? You get what you went for. It looks just like you envisioned it. It's fantastic. You put it on social media and like 7 people like it. what exactly. The heck, man? It's so, I don't know. But then I'll post a cell phone picture of a, you know, a banded duck and everyone's excited about that. So
yeah, that's my feeling with geese. I just feel like, especially snow geese, like I could have the greatest picture ever of a snow goose and it's just crickets. And like I took this one in Oregon years ago of this Canada goose. He's standing in this little creek bed and it's like some good current in there, and it's like the light is right at dusk. The lighting's so perfect. And just above the water, you can see like 3/4 of the band sticking out of the water. It's like, from a photography standpoint, one of the best pictures I've ever taken. And I posted on social media and it's just crickets. And I can just, but then you go the next day, post just some random picture of a pintail and it gets 10 times the engagement. So it's crazy how that works. It's just when I think this is going to be really good and people are going to love this, it's does nothing. And yet one that I think, oh, this is all right. And it gets a ton of engagement. So,
yeah. Yeah. Cause I reposted Kaysen's video of these speckle bellies that are here in late April. And my comment was, you know, what if they stayed around? Basically it was saying, what if they stayed around like these resident Canada geese, would they be as cool to hunt? Cause you know, specs right now, turkeys, you know, they have this definite sex appeal, so to speak, where you post anything about anything related to those birds, you know, people just go nuts. You know, I don't know, I guess that's what it is. You know, Canada geese and snow geese aren't as cool.
That's kind of the way I feel about like pintails. Seems like people just have this love for pintails, and I don't get me wrong, but I mean, pintail's a beautiful bird. Obviously it's one of my favorite photographs, but any sort of pintail picture always gets more engagement than pretty much any other species that I post. It's always seems to be that way.
Speaking of species that don't get a lot of love, tell everybody about your affection for rams.
Yeah. So, the whole thing started with years ago. A buddy of ours has a pit in Arkansas, and they it's between two incredible rest areas. And so they shoot a six man, nothing but greenheads pretty much every day. And one of his buddies would always shoot, if a shoveler came in, would shoot it just to piss off his friend so that it'd mess up the picture. So he shoots one day and yells, "Guts, glory, Ram." And we all laughed. So since then, we've just been calling them Rams. And it kind of took on a whole thing of its own, this thing with, but yeah, shovelers, like I grew up, you know, we hunted the Mississippi Delta, catfish ponds and stuff like that. So shovelers were awesome to shoot because, you know, if you had a group of three or four of them come in and you shoot one or two, just wait a second, they'll make another pass and the other two are going to come back in and give you another shot. And so we shot a lot of shovelers over the years. So it's always turned an okay hunt into a good hunt or a bad hunt into an okay hunt.
Yeah, I'm not a purist by any means. I go duck hunting and I'm happy to, if it wants a decoy, I'm happy to oblige it. So I've always shot them. They seem to be getting smarter though. I swear, you know, back in the 90s, early 2000s, they would decoy almost like teal. Now it's a little bit more of a challenge, but I think I've told you this. I was right there close to DU headquarters when I was a kid. And I remember seeing this bumper sticker on the back of a car. It said spoonbills have green heads too. And it's been like my favorite bumper sticker ever. Like I gotta reprint
nice.
That.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, we'll do our first collab together, Ed. We'll get that thing printed up.
I'm in. I've actually been working on, and I think you know, I've talked about this as well. Like I've got this idea that I've been that's gonna be this video based around shovelers I've been working on for 3 or 4 years now. And we've tried to do it a couple times to film this deal with them and had it locked up last year. We're going to do it, had it set for like January 17th. We're going to go film this thing. And that ice came through and just screwed the whole thing up. So we're going to try it again next year, but if we can ever get it done, I think it's going to be really, really good. It's there's no video I want to shoot more than this one. Because I've tried it so many times and I just hadn't worked out, but eventually I'm going to get it. It's going to be good when it comes out, if we ever get it done.
I haven't been seeing as many of those. You know, it kind of gets back to your comment on them not decoying as strong. I don't think I've seen as many loafing around, especially with this past season with this mild winter. I didn't note just an inordinate amount of spoonbills, a lot of teal all the way through January, but didn't see the number of spoonbills that you, one would think you'd see.
Well, and true to them not getting love, you know, as much as we talk numbers and population, I have no idea what the spoonbill population is doing right now.
No, I hadn't been tracking that one as close.
I think it was down. I think I saw it last year. I think it was down a little bit, but it wasn't like drastic. So
yeah, Ed's paying attention.
Yeah, always. That's the first one I scroll down to find.
So. Oh man, that's funny. That's funny. Well, you know, I know you travel all over the place. You know, looking at, you know, some of your photos, you got stuff all the way from Canada all the way to Louisiana and everywhere in between. So, you know, coming off this past season where it was really odd, you know, it was the mildest winter we've had in quite some time. It was really dry. Kind of what are some of your observations from your travels? We've had people from on the show that have been all over the place as well. And you know, Casey and I's personal focus is pretty narrow because we don't leave Arkansas. I've been to Saskatchewan. I've been to Kansas. I've been to Oklahoma, but not this past season. But we've gathered some input from other guests on what they saw this past season. So I'm curious kind of what your thoughts were from this weird 23-24.
So for the last, I think 10 years or so, I've got an Excel sheet on my computer that has basically a breakdown of every hunt I've been on for the last 10 years, where we hunted, how many ducks we killed, who I was with, et cetera. And it seemed like this year, I hunted 79 days this year in I think like 9 different states and 2 different provinces in Canada. And it felt like at a lot of times, like it was really, really slow, but at the end of the season, I was looking at it and it was the most ducks I had ever seen shot in any season, which was crazy to me. It, that granted, some of those were out in Oklahoma. It was really, really good. The guys out there that filmed with Crash Landing out there, they're usually on them just about every day. So the hunts we had out there was really, really good. And we did shot a few episodes of DUTV, or a couple episodes of DUTV and a short film up in Prince Edward Island with Paul McKinnon up there. And we did really good up there. And our other trip to Canada was really good. So that kind of helped. But like, I hunted Mississippi a little bit this year, and it was really, really slow. So it was kind of weird. Like, it felt like it was really slow, but, and we hunted a bunch of public land for the first time in several years this year, and had a couple hunts where we really didn't do much, but had several where we, you know, limited out and had really good hunts. So it was kind of a weird season. Like, it, like I said, it felt like it was slow, but, you know, the statistics said otherwise. So it was almost like it was, every hunt was either kind of a bust or really, really good. And yeah. I'm very fortunate that I'm usually filming. So I get to go film at some of the better places. So my perspective is probably a little skewed, probably a lot different than other folks. But yeah, that's kind of what it was for me. It was either like feast or famine, seemed like.
Well, you know, maybe a little skewed, but I would say your barometer would still be, you're comparing it to the similar property year in and year out.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. The season before seemed like it was one of the best ever. And this season seemed a little bit slow, but you know, the previous season I'd hunted 81 days and seen less ducks get shot than this year, 79, which I guess that's basically the same, but it last season or the two seasons ago just felt like it was like we were on them every time. And this season, like I said, it didn't feel that way, but I saw more ducks get shot.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That was very similar to my experience too. When we were on them, we were on them. There wasn't kind of any in between. We killed 100, just over 100 more speckle bellies than we did in the previous season. But I probably got skunked more than I probably ever have. I mean, I know three or four hunts with nothing. Didn't even click the safety off. But the days we were on them, it was lights out, and the mallards were kind of the same. So that's very similar. But and I think that's a good point to make, that you know, with what you're doing, you're getting to go to some really good places, and even some of the days at those kind of places, you don't catch them. Right.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard for anybody to kill them every day, but yeah. Kind of circling back to Oklahoma, cause we had a lot of these discussions back in the fall, when we kind of got the podcast first going, what do you think led to being so good in Oklahoma this particular year?
I mean, honestly, I feel like Oklahoma's like my second home now. I've been out there so much in the last 3 years. But it's kind of been that way ever since I've been going out there. It's only been, like I said, the last, I guess, three or four seasons that I've been filming out there. But it seems like every time we've been out that we go out there, they've just always on them. And granted, the guys at Crash Landing, the setup they've got, they're hunting, I think it's they've got permission or leases on like 90,000 acres. So they've got 8 or 9 guides/scouts. So they're on them just about every day. So the setup they've got makes it, I feel like sometimes seem like there's more ducks than there actually are, just mm-hmm. because their operations, the way they do it, they very seldom are you on a, they don't miss a whole lot of days. Very seldom do you have bad hunts out there just because they've got so many guys watching so many areas that they've got it down to a science out there. But
yeah, imagine if he could roam 90,000 acres in Arkansas. How'd you do
it? Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was great out there this year, but it's been great out there every year that I've been out there. But I'm sure for a lot of people, it's a little different story depending on the area you are and this kind of setup you have. Hunting out there, it's so different than hunting the Mississippi Flyway, whereas, you know, you find, you know, a hole in Arkansas in the timber, you can go shoot it two or three days in a row. Whereas out there, you're shooting a lot of cattle ponds and stuff, and you shoot it one day and they're gone. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not coming back the next day. You can't go shoot that same spot two or three days in a row. So that's why you got to have such a large area to hunt out there, so that you can cover. Those ducks are going to move from one spot to the other after you shoot them. They're not hanging around for a couple of days.
Right.
So you got to have a big tracks planned to hunt and be able to cover them and find the ducks.
Yeah. That's what we even drove when I went. We were actually in South Central Kansas, but we hunted two of the days in Oklahoma. So, I mean, it's just wide landscape to pick from. But in your time out there, have you noticed an uptick in the number of outfitters, the competition for these, these leases and permissions and everything else?
Yeah. Hunting Oklahoma is new to me over the last 4 years or so, but as competitive as Arkansas public land hunting is, the outfitter game in Oklahoma is right next to, like, they're about the same. It's crazy how competitive that the outfitter game in Oklahoma is. And a lot of those outfitters get along. I know, like, if one outfitter's kind of struggling, that the other ones will help them out. But they also there's some that have a lot of animosity between them. So it's kind of a crazy deal out there. Like, it's not as many people hunting public land where you've got that competition. It's more in the outfitters. It's what I've noticed. So
that's interesting. And I think we've had other guests on that kind of alluded to that or talked about it. I know, Ed, you've told me some stories about, being out there and
it's pretty cutthroat.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Totally different from here. Like, you don't have that with outfitters here. I mean, there's competition for leases and stuff, but it's not a lot of competition I see, door to door like that.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
But you've hunted, a lot of really, really cool places across the country, and that's something we want to kind of do multi-part episode coming up with some different folks about different locations and, specialty hunts. But you mentioned Prince Edward Island. Tell me, what are some of the coolest places you've gone? I know particularly with DUTV, you've been not unheard of, but places like I wouldn't come to my mind immediately to go hunt ducks. I mean, like, I've seen some of your pictures with mountains in the background, and that, that catches me off guard a little bit when it comes to duck hunting.
Yeah, me too. It's the Prince Edward Island. It was crazy. So we've been trying to film this DU hunt there for like 3 years. 1 year, the COVID restrictions they had lifted the ban for Canada, but the restrictions on the island were so bad that DU just decided not to do it because it was just wasn't worth it. And then the following year, we were like set to fly out on a Thursday. And on Monday, a hurricane hits Prince Edward Island. And it was like a bucket list spot for me because one of the only ducks I'd never photographed or didn't really have good pictures of were black ducks. And that's what we were going there. That's what we were targeting in Prince Edward Island. And when I told my wife years ago that we were going to film a DU episode at Prince Edward Island, she was like, wow, I've always wanted to go there. I've heard it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. So that coupled with the opportunity to photograph a black duck, I was excited to go to Prince Edward Island. And like 3 years in a row, it didn't happen. Something kept us from going. It was COVID 2 years, then the hurricane. So I was a little scared that this year, it wouldn't happen. But we finally got up there and it lived up to the billing. It was, of all the places I've been, it's by far my favorite the guys we hunted up there with, I think, really helped with that, though, because, you know, who you're hunting with makes a big difference. But it's this guy, Paulie McKinney, who's been a big duck hunter with pro staff guy from Avery and a bunch of other zinc calls and stuff for over the years. But his little crew, man, they were just some of the best guys I've ever met. And like the whole, I rode around most of Prince Edward Island trying to find ducks and geese to photograph. And I was just blown away at how gorgeous it was up there. It was crazy. But yeah, like we talked about the mountains years ago, I filmed a swan hunt out in northern Utah, just north of, we actually did a hunt in Great Salt Lake. But it was one of the coolest places I've been. And then maybe the Platte River, Nebraska, gone out there for the last 5 or 6 years with a buddy of ours out there. It's one of my favorite places to go. So outside of the standard Arkansas flooded timber, which is always going to be my favorite, those are some of the probably cooler places I've been.
Yeah, the swan hunt is something that's kind of on my list to go do one day. You know, you sit here and think about places to go, and you want to go, I would want to go experience something that, you know, I couldn't do here. Like black duck would be a pretty good example too. We have killed one here in the last, you know, forever, it seems like. But like, I don't know, to me, going and killing mallard somewhere is not super exciting. The work restrictions, everything else, it's hard for me to get away. So if I'm going to go somewhere, I want it to be something I could never do at home. Like swan's pretty high on that list. I think that'd be pretty cool.
The swan hunt was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you're good. I was going to say, I don't know that Utah would come to mind when I think about swans, but yeah, what were you going to say?
So the swan hunt, it was, I'd been filming in Nebraska like the day before, and we finished filming that morning, and I drove to Denver, caught a flight, and flew into Salt Lake City. Well, the guy picked me up. He picked me up at like 9 o'clock at night. So it's dark and we're hunting public land. That first day, we're actually just hunting divers. We weren't going to swan hunt till the next day. So he picks you up at 9 o'clock at night, and we leave out at 3 a.m. So it's dark when we leave. And I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't what I saw when the sun started to come up. Just the backdrop was like unbelievable. It's these snow-capped mountains. And I was just like, oh my gosh. It was just crazy how beautiful it was. But the swan hunt is kind of probably the only time I've ever got really nervous filming. Cause you know, the guy's got one swan tag, and if swan comes in and he shoots and you don't get it on film, it's a bad deal. And I was honestly
blame the cameraman.
Right. And so we had like this perfect setup where we're up in some big cattails and stuff. It's big open water. So there's nothing in front of me. That's the perfect scenario to film in autofocus, even for video, when you don't have anything in front of you and you lock onto that bird. But the wind switched, and all of a sudden it went from being at our backs to coming from our left. And so the swan's coming in from the right, and to the right of us is just these big cattails. And I was like, oh man. So I switched it to manual. I was like, I'm not going to miss this. And so when he shot it, I knew I got it on film. It was this huge sigh of relief. And because I was thinking, man, if I miss it, it's going to be a bad deal. He's flown me out here and paid me a bunch of money to come film this hunt. And if I miss it, you only get one shot at it. So, but yeah, that's the only time I've ever been like super nervous filming one.
Well, I made that joke there for those that have never been around anything getting filmed like that, or for that level of production, and anything that goes wrong will always get blamed on the cameraman. You can
for sure
guarantee it. Yeah. And look, I've been on both sides of it. A lot of times it is a cameraman's fault.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even our spec episode, you know, like you go back and you watch it on TV, and I think Jimbo is talking about, you know, the second day we didn't do as good. We didn't kill as many birds. So as the host, I'm like, well, Jimbo, why don't you tell them that we had three guys sitting out there holding, you know, giant black cameras that didn't bother to hide. You make it sound like we were struggling because of where we're at. We were struggling because of what we're having to do. So, and Brent and I've talked about that a little bit on the episode, but tell us, Ed, if you can try to explain, I don't know if you can paint the picture, but like,
I've always said there's a huge difference in hunting and hunting for TV. It's totally different when you've got guys outside the blind. You're trying to hide. Anytime you've got a camera, you're never going to be hit as well. And you're not going to shoot as many ducks or turkeys or anything. You know, that's when you've got a camera involved, you've constantly got to move to film ducks and stuff. So it's your success rate's never going to be as high if you've got a camera, but you know, that's just part of it. And so,
yeah,
it does, but it definitely, it makes it tougher when you're filming versus just hunt.
It does. I mean, it changes the hunt entirely. And as someone, I mean, all three of us are hunters, you know, but you go into one of these hunts, especially from my perspective, where you've hosted several of them. And the first thing everyone starts talking about is that, okay, you know, this isn't about the hunt. It's about capturing it. You know, 5 good ones are better than 50 that are bad. I'm like, hang on, that math doesn't compute to me. So like, I'm going to put the birds in front of us. Y'all got a video, you know, you got to do your part, but it changes everything. The focus is about, you know, not pass shooting. You want everything where the cameraman can get it. It's I don't know. You watch a 20-minute episode on TV and you think, oh, that's cool, that looks like a lot of fun, but you really can't understand.
There's a lot that goes into it for sure.
A lot. Yeah. A lot of work, a lot of effort.
Like we filmed a couple of DU episodes in Denver, or just outside Denver, one year. And the first day we shot it was a 4 or 6 man limited. I think it's a 6 man limited ducks, but it just wasn't like we didn't. Guy Shepard that does DUTV, he and I were talking about it. I said, yeah, you know, they shot him, but we didn't shoot him good. Like, I guess that means like, it's not going to be great. It's not going to be ideal film. Like the light kind of facing into the sun. And they're kind of swinging from one side. They're not, you know, squared up in the hole coming in front of you. And then the last day we shot maybe it was the first day we shot a 6 man. The last day we shot like a 3 or 4 man, but they were all you know, like a sunny southeast wind, which is a cameraman's dream. They're centered up right in the hole, just backpedaling. And you'd rather shoot a 3 man like that than a 6 man, you know, then swinging from one side or shooting into the sun, stuff like that. There's a whole lot of variables that you have to take into consideration when you're trying to film for TV that it seems like you're always up against. That sunny southeast wind, just, I always say it happens 3 times a season, and you got to make the most of it when it does.
Oh man, no doubt. I can't remember the last time it was sunny and the wind was out of the southeast. It's just, you're right. It is so rare. But you know, my only experience, you know, as far as filming for TV, I've been involved in 2 episodes of RNTV. We filmed one at Greenbrier. I actually filmed over 2 days there. And then this past season, we filmed one at Bull Sprig. But, you know, Blake Fisher does all that by himself. There's no other cameras. He's just back there kind of blending into the scenery and capturing, you know, some cool footage. But do you do it by yourself, or do you have some sidekicks you take along to help, you know, get different angles and different shots out of the same hunt, or is it one camera?
So on DUTV, we've always got 2 cameras, and that second camera just makes such a world of difference. If you've got somebody you've got a main camera guy that's in the blind, he's doing shooting B-roll in the blind, conversations, over the shoulder, kill shots. And then you've got a second guy that's usually outside the blind in some sort of hide, and all he's filming is just ducks. Like, he's got a bigger lens and he's filming just ducks. So that makes such a huge difference. So when we're filming DUTV and some other stuff, usually I always try to have a second camera guy. But for instance, like Lost Break, we've done 30 plus episodes of it. And I think I've had a second camera guy on 2 of them. It's been just me. And when it's just you, it's so much tougher because there's different shots you want to get, but you know, it's hard to do it when it's just the one person. So having that second camera guys, if you can have, I try to, nowadays that I've got guys that are working for me that are really good camera guys as well, like I always try to have a second camera guy if possible.
Yeah, makes sense, because I'm sure it's happened for you on the single camera shoots, is you get back to the editing it and you're like, man, I did not get, you know, you remember it with your eyes what happened, but whether you got it with a camera, because you can't, it's not like a redo. You don't get to ask the ducks,
yeah,
hey, could y'all make that pass one more time and bank over that tree and flutter in like you did a minute ago, because I didn't quite get it. So it's, I mean, the pressure's on a cameraman for sure.
Yeah, and if it's just you, so if you've got a 28-70 lens and you're doing an over-the-shoulder shot, that's great and all, but it's kind of like you're kind of delegated to that unless you've got a chance where you can switch lenses and then walk to a different spot of the hole to get put on a bigger lens where you can get a more tighter shot of ducks coming in. But when you do that, now you can't film the audio of, because you've moved away, of guys talking after the volley or anything like that, or you know, them working ducks coming in. So it makes it challenging when it's just you, and because you've got those two cameras, you're getting two completely different perspectives of the ducks coming in. You're getting one where it's from the perspective of the hunter. You're shooting this over the shoulder shot. You're videoing guys calling, pulling jerk cords, that kind of stuff. And then your second camera, you're getting the more tighter shot where it's, you're just seeing the duck and nothing else. And so it helps where you've got that, you're getting different angles. So it's not the same repetitive shot each time as ducks come in. So it makes it a lot better, like I said, when you've got that second guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have an all-time catastrophic whiff on a photo that you wish you got or thought you got and you didn't?
I can tell you the photo that sticks out. We were at Lost Break filming. It was like the first year we ever filmed there, and it was opening morning, and this group of ducks comes in, and we shoot into them, and it's kind of an overcast day, and one duck kind of sails out a little bit after we shoot him and goes down, and right as he did, this bald eagle comes out of nowhere and lands right on the corner, right above this duck. And this hole, it's kind of shaped like an L. And right there is, it makes a bend of the L. The eagle lands right there, basically on top of this duck. And I realized what's about to happen. I was like, oh, this is going to be epic. So I kind of switched my camera settings real quick to adjust for what's about to happen. And the eagle starts to fly down to grab this duck. And one of the guys with us goes to hollering at the eagle and spooks it. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I was like, man, I was about to get a shot of this eagle picking up this greenhead off the water in timber and didn't get it. I was like, dude. And he said, man, my bad. The other one I can think of as far as videos, we were having a low water year, Lost Break, and kind of struggling for some video. And we finally got a little water and got on a good hunt, and one of my buddies, Martin from Louisiana, was hunting with us, and I'm right behind him, and this greenhead makes this swing into the hole, and he's on a bigger tree, and there's like this V in the tree, and as the duck swings, he swings right through that V, and I'm like dead on him, an over the shoulder shot, and as he pulls his gun off the tree, I kind of like follow with the gun, and it was like one of the best shots I've ever framed up. And I'm literally looking right down his barrel at his bead, and this duck swings and finishes 10 yards in front of him backpedaling, and he misses him three times. And he turns around and looks, he just turns around and looks at me, and I can only imagine the face I had. You know, it was just like, oh. And he said, my bad. And I just looked at him. I said, man, I really, really needed you to shoot that duck. So I still gave him hell about it. Yeah, it's been a tough year, man. I really needed you to shoot that duck. And it was at 120 frames per second, so it's super slow-mo, and it's just like, it was like one of those where as I'm filming it, I was like, oh man, this is framed up so good. And it's just like he shoulders it, and when he shoulders it, like he's on the right side of the frame because he's left-handed, the duck's right there on the left, and it's just perfect, and he whiffs. Yeah, that's, you know, it happens though. I mean, it's my biggest complaint always is, and Jimbo and I actually, Casey, we talked about this at your place that we were filming that spec hunt, was that Jimbo made some comment about the camera guy not being on the duck. And I was like, hold on. I was like, for the record, hunters shoot the wrong duck. And I was like, as a camera guy, when a group of ducks comes in, I was like, let me just tell you, the one, like, if it's my thing is like four more ducks, I try to zoom out and get as wide to get as many ducks in the frame as possible. But if it's two or three, like, you're going to kind of get in tight where it's a little bit better framed up shot. And it never fails. A group of ducks comes in and that lead greenhead backpedaling over the decoys at 10 yards. When somebody calls a shot, like clockwork, everybody raises up and nobody shoots that duck, because it's when you raise up instinctively, you're like, well, everybody's going to shoot that one.
Right.
I'm going to shoot this one over here. And it ends up, that's the one the camera guy's on, because it's the greenhead backpedaling in the middle of the decoys, and it doesn't get shot. We had it happen when we were filming DUTV up in Ontario, and this group of redheads decoy is perfect as you can get. And the lead one is just literally at 10 yards backpedaling. It's actually two of them right there, just backpedaling over the decoys. And I'm running the bird camera, so I'm zoomed in tight on those two. And those are the only two, I think, that nobody shot at. And I was just like, oh, man, it was framed up so good. And nobody shot at those. And so that's always been I kind of joke around that being my pet peeve, that nobody ever shoots the gimme duck. Everybody always kind of picks out a different one, because they, like I said, they just assume that that's the duck that everybody's going to raise up and shoot at. So they're going to shoot at a different one. And it ends up, nobody ends up shooting that one and it gets out.
Yeah. Well, you know,
it happens more than you think, I promise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Remember that spec episode, that big group that, you know, they were coming right to left, and Kyle and I'd lost track of how many birds, because we were in a little bit of an elevated blind, like it was in a blind we duck hunt out of, and I would lose them in front of the blind. I had no idea how many birds had lit. And finally, like, you know, we're under the spin and we get the majority of that spin on us. We call the shot, and I don't remember who was running the bird camera, but he was sitting there watching them, you know, land in the decoys, and wondered what we were ever going to do, if we were going to shoot or not. And we stand up and shoot, and I'm out of shells before the birds that were in the decoys got up and left. And we had all lost track of how close they were. And I mean, we still got the shot, but it didn't really do justice to how many birds were there and how really cool that was. And the majority of that fault laid on me, you know, for calling the shot when I did, and not calling it maybe a little bit sooner when the bird camera was focused on the birds that were there, you know?
I actually posted a reel back during duck season that said like PSA, shoot the ducks in the decoys. It was we're up in Canada dry field hunting this big group of about 30 mallards, just do it perfectly. Well, there's four that come in, and they're, when you pop up, they're eye level high, backpedaling right there with the spinners. And the rest of the group is kind of above everybody. So everybody pops up, and I froze the video right there and put a little circle that said, shoot these. And you watch, everybody sticks their guns up in the air, and nobody, not a single shot got fired at the four that are right there in the middle of the decoys.
I've kind of had the opposite experience. You know, when I take buddies spec hunting, and they, you know, they don't spec hunt a lot. Everybody wants to stand up and drill the one that's right in front of, you know, right in front of the pit or whatever we're hunting, A-frame, whatever we're hunting out of. And then, you know, you got all this wad of geese hovering over decoys, some are on the ground, and you look up and there's two dead geese out of, you know, 100 that you got hovering in the decoys, because everybody stood up and shot that one,
yeah,
you know, the one dead to rights goose. So I started asking people, or if their buddies are, I just tell them, because I know who the worst shot is. But if it's people I don't know that well, I'll say, well, who's the worst shot? And, you know, somebody else said, well, that's, you know, so-and-so. I said, all right, well, so-and-so, the first group that comes in, the closest goose, you shoot that one. Everybody else shoots something else. And that's tended to work a little better and do a little more damage when a bigger group comes in versus everybody just tattooing the one or two that are right in front of everybody's gun barrel.
Yeah.
We go through that in our safety meeting. Try to explain to people, you know, shoot, stay in your lane. Like, don't everyone shoot the first duck, which is against cameraman rules, but a little different situation for us. But invariably, everybody will shoot the close duck, and you know, big group comes in, you kill two ducks out of it, and you're like, guys, there's four of y'all. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Ed, you're telling stories about missing shots. I'll tell this one real quick, and then I've got a follow-up question. So I was shooting some content for an ammo company this year, and was focused tight on the gun, on the action, like wanted to get the hull coming out, you know, saw the bird working. It's like, all right, here's my chance. I'm gonna get in tight. This is how this is gonna go. Boom. Just pure happenstance. I don't know if the powder burnt slow or what the primer did, but it fired enough to cycle the gun. And when it kicked the hull out, it lit the rest of the powder that hadn't burnt. And it was this epic fireball out the side of the action. And I saw it like as I'm shooting, like the flash. And I was like, man, that didn't look right. You know, they're going to pick up the bird. I'm scrolling back through the images. I'm like, holy crap, look at this fireball. And I showed it to the guy. I was like, hey, did you notice anything different? He was like, no, not really. Showed him the picture. He's like, well, it did feel warmer. I'm like, yeah, you say that now. But so have you ever been in a situation where like you're just blind luck, get a really cool shot because you were shooting something else? Total opposite of what we're just talking about.
Yeah, like so I've actually got that, like the fireball coming out. Like one of the first crash videos we shot, it was the same thing. I was like over the shoulder, and like you get a, like I think it's, I don't, I, I'm not 100%. I think it's like a little, maybe having a little too much powder in there or something, but it'll throw action. And so when I saw it, I was like, man, I had the same reaction you did. I was like, oh, that's crazy. And I've gotten a couple steals of kind of the same thing. The one, I guess, the talking about just pure luck that you weren't trying to get. I've got a picture, and it's from 5 or 6 years ago. We were teal hunting in Mississippi, and it was me and my cousin and my next door neighbor. And it wasn't like we were burning them down. I think we shot 4 teal and 6 snakes that morning. But one of the teal we shot, it sailed out. My dog went and got it, and I was kind of hustled about 30 yards to my right because I knew which way, you know, I wanted him to come back towards me where the lighting was just perfect, where he'd be completely front lit. And as he's coming back, I dropped down, basically laying on the ground to get that perfect angle. And I'm just shooting it as fast as I can as he's coming back. And I like noticed something, but it really didn't dawn on me. And he gets back and my cousin says, hey, did you see that? And I was like, what? And I said, yeah, I saw something like go through the viewfinder. He was like, yeah, some fish jumped up. And so I scroll back through, and right as he's coming through the water, these two shad jump up, and they're like right next to his head. And I got 2 frames of it. So it's just pure luck. But it was like, it's one of my favorite shots I've ever taken, where it just, you could never recreate that, and just complete blind luck. But it worked out good.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. It's funny how you kind of luck into some stuff sometimes. Cause I've taken post hunt pictures, cause I'm not trying to catch birds in action or anything like that, but post hunt pictures and don't even realize it. And I know you got some photographers that Photoshop those into the background, but I've got a handful of that particular day, geese were still working or the ducks were still or whatever. And it's authentic, real birds in the background that when I was taking the picture, I had no idea. I wasn't paying attention. I was trying to make sure everybody's eyes were open and everybody was looking at the camera and all that to get the post hunt pick. But I've lucked into a few things like that too, where the sky is just full of real ducks, not Photoshop ducks or geese in the background. So I always thought that was kind of cool.
I feel like you see the Photoshop ducks or birds in the background more and more these days. Like I'm not knocking on anybody. I don't even know how to use Photoshop, to be honest, but I've actually, it's such a cool shot when somebody does it, like when they add in those, but that, you know, to each their own. Like some guys are really great at that and it makes for awesome images. I just kind of try to like not over edit stuff and just get more of a natural look, I guess, or whatever. But I have like tried to take that picture a few times where I've noticed it before. We were up in Canada one time in Alberta filming. And as we were riding out, there was just these massive wads of geese. And it was like the perfect time of year where I've never seen the leaves on trees this color. It was almost like it didn't look real because they were so bright orange. It looked like, even just straight out of camera, it looked like you had just over edited this picture because they were just that orange. It was crazy. But there's these massive groups of geese flying over this lake we were on. And so I had told the guy in this other boat, I was like, hey, go out 100 yards, you know, 75 yards to our right and like drive like a 45 right in front of us. And because I wanted to get a picture of the boat, them in the boat with these geese in the background. And I got a couple of them, but it took two or three tries. He wasn't quite understanding the directions and kept going in the wrong, kind of not at the right angle, but I finally got a couple of them. But yeah, sometimes take photos that, I mean, you're setting up intentionally, but sometimes some of the best ones I've ever gotten are just by complete accident. Something happens, like you said earlier, Kason, that you don't even know it at the time. And then when you look back through it, you notice it and it's ends up being something really good.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And talking about those Photoshop ones, I mean, there's a guy and he's been on the show. He's been on the show more than once. He's really good at it. And a lot of people try to replicate that style.
He's the best at it.
he's the best at it. And you can definitely tell people try to replicate it and some look okay. And some are like, there's no way those ducks were in that background. And then it goes on down from there. But yeah, so we're getting about an hour in and we had this question on our roster of things to ask every guest. Some of our episodes run longer, especially when you get the science guys on and they get to rambling and rolling and get hot on a topic. But we meant to ask this question to every guest and we haven't been able to do it, but we figured today we had time to work this in. I want to make sure we gave you an opportunity to do it. But if you could change one thing about modern day duck hunting, what would it be and why?
Man, I knew you were about to ask me that.
We even had a guest that was all teed up to answer it. And we didn't answer it. And then he told us his answer after we got off the air.
We forgot to ask.
What was his answer? What was his answer? Can I use his? whoever it was probably better than the one I've got. I mean, I don't know.
There's got to be something. There's got to be something you'd like. So it'd be a little different. Doesn't have to be a culture thing. Doesn't have to be doesn't have to be anything controversial by any means.
I mean, there's a couple things, like there's nothing that really that just bugs me or that I'm like hardcore, I wish this was different. I guess the two things that come to mind, that stands out, like we used to hunt a bunch of public land. We used to hunt basically all public land. And it seems recently, since we didn't have any water on the island this year, we were delegated to hunt a bunch of public land, which was actually kind of cool. We went back and hunted a bunch of old spots that we used to hunt years ago. And it seems like more and more, you hear these stories or you see it in person of guys getting beat to the hole and having this mentality of, well, we're hunting here anyway. And I know that's just part of it, especially on low water years when there's X amount of holes that have water and X amount of hunters, you're going to have some of that. I get it. And sometimes it ends up being, you meet new people and it ends up being great. But when you get into this, a hole that'll hide eight people and you've got three groups trying to hunt it, it doesn't work out. And I guess having a little honor and hole running, if you get beat, have a plan B and C. And I feel like what you're seeing these days and what we've experienced is a lot of guys don't necessarily have the plan B, C, and D. They're just like, hey, if we get beat, we're hunting there anyway. And all that's doing is, neither group's going to be successful for the most part at that point. It's different if it's, you got two or three guys and all of a sudden two guys show up, but when it's 10 and 10, you end up with 20 in a hole. I know there's been some talk about changing, putting, party limits on there. And I wish that's something they would take a look at and figure out. I don't have the solution for it necessarily. Cause like I said, I know on low water years, it's part of it, but you know, a lot of times when it's, even when it's not low water, you still have a lot of that mentality. And I wish A, the powers that be would look at trying to fix that, and B, the guys that have that mentality would look at maybe doing less of that and trying to go elsewhere if you do get beat. That would be the only thing that comes to mind, honestly. And it's not, like I said, I mean, most of the, it's not like I'm out there hunting public land every single day. I actually, we probably did 15 days on, or 20 days on public land this year. So it was a decent amount, but that's the only thing that really comes to mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good one, Ed. And I mean, I'll add this to it. I really don't want to see any kind of regulation coming down as far as group size. I think once we start down that path, it's a very, very slippery slope, you know, to regulating what you can and can't do party size. I would rather, because I think it's a culture issue, right? Same thing with the surface drives. Like, I don't want to see a ban on surface drives, because to me, that's akin to banning firearms to stop, you know, criminal actions. Like, it's a culture thing, right? It's not the surface drive that's causing the problem. It's the guy driving it. Same thing in the situation you're talking about, you know, like, I just think we kind of have this culture issue where we don't really consider our actions in regards to hunting or anything else we do beyond the window in which we're hunting. And I feel like maybe some of the sportsmanship is kind of lost today, or maybe we're drifting away from that. And I think that's kind of the impetus behind this podcast too, is to, you know, talk about these issues and maybe kind of get back to that, how we were brought up, you know, with your father or grandfather teaching you, yeah, this is what you do and this is why you do it. So I like your comment. I think that's a very good one.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And you're exactly right. And maybe it's not, maybe the answer isn't limiting, you know, hunting parties, but I, like I said, I guess it's just, you know, like we shot an episode about it this year, but this, you know, we went to great lengths to get this one hole and we got it. And the guys, there was some, you know, there was some pushback at first, because these guys have been hunting this hole and we beat them, and they eventually did their, you know, they went somewhere else, which is great. But we had some, you know, we had a couple of days where we beat somebody the hole and they hunted, you know, it's like they hunted with us, but they were, those couple of times they were super cordial about it and said, hey guys, y'all mind if we jump in here with y'all? And we were like, absolutely, come on. But it was too many people and we ended up not having successful hunts. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I just think that, to me, it's, you know, hey, we left at 1:30 to get here to do this, or, you know, you got guys sleeping in their trucks. Like, if we're all just gonna say, hey, if we get beat, let's just hunt here, then, you know, what are we doing out here this early? Let's just get here at 6. Everybody right. Just get here at 6, and, you know, so I feel like there's got to be some honor there, and it's got to start with, you know, your group saying, all right, well, we got beat, we're going to plan B. And like I said, I understand that, I'm not naive, that sometimes that's not an option, that if there's x amount of water and x amount of hunters, you're going to have some overlap. But when conditions are favorable, for when there's plenty of water and plenty of holes, you know, go somewhere else and go to your plan B.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we can't,
my 2-minute rant.
Yeah, no, it's, well, we could rant even longer, but it's one of those things where if we don't self-regulate, someone's going to do it for us. And I promise you, we will not like the regulation that comes down. And I'm hearing some talk already about, you know, maybe a regulation in regards to party size. And to me, you know, it's going to, you're just one step closer towards going to a draw system. And I don't think anybody wants to see that. So,
yeah, nobody wants that. So, yeah, I mean, you're probably right there, though. It's probably needs to be more self-regulation than government regulation or state regulation. Well,
while we still got the chance anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, Ed, man, can't tell you how much I appreciate you answering the call today and hopping on the show with us. You've been on my list for a long time to get on here. I knew it would be a good episode. So, I appreciate your time. Thanks for jumping on with us. We're going to get out of here. You guys can find us online at The Standard Sportsman. You can find us on social media at the same. Appreciate you all listening.
Light boots, the lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighed in at just 13 ounces each. Putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.